Cliffcentral.com, 6 minutes after 1 o'clock on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Mabale Moloi, and this is the News Talk Hour with the Daily Maverick edition. As usual, we go through some of the top news stories that you and I are talking about. Ranjeni Munsami is joining me in the studio this afternoon. And then we're having an interesting conversation outside, because the way that your surname is spelt is very misleading, because it's spelled M-U-N-U-S-U-S-A-S-A-M-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And it's confusing, because when you read it, you want to say Munusami, which is not correct.
Well, here's the stuff up. When my dad was a baby and he was being registered, so he went to whatever Apartheid Home Affairs was called then. His dad went and was spelling this to this clerk who was going, yes, yes. And so he spelled M-U. He said U-N-U-S-U. So that's how my dad ended up with the extra U in his surname. The rest of my family is spelled M-U-N-S-A-M-Y. We got an extra U. So I'm stuck with this extra U. Hey?
Oh, my goodness.
And try spelling that to like a call center person, yeah, or, you, yeah, know. It even gets worse. You know, you end up with like three U's, you know. And it sounds like a cow, you know, mooing.
It would probably be a more difficult process than it is giving birth, just to get Home Affairs to fix that mistake.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, that's why I'm rather stuck with this, the second U, which is a silent U, you know, for the rest of my life, than trying to go through this process with Home Affairs. They probably think I'm a terrorist trying to, you know, adjust my surname to, dodge.
It's at Ranjeni M on Twitter. You can follow her. You tweet a lot about the World Cup, hey, the FIFA World Cup. You enjoy your football.
Oh, yeah, I'm a bit of a freak, hey?
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, because, you know, I grew up in a small town and there wasn't much else to do, except, you know, to play with the guys, play ball with the guys.
So, and you then actually played yourself?
Yeah, I used to play with them and then watch it with them. And so, you know, it's kind of in my blood. But the problem now is that I have to work in between games, you know.
Oh,
so
how inconvenient.
That really gets in the way sometimes, especially when there's two games.
Yeah.
And I have 2 hours in between and like I have to type fast. Let me get this done so I can watch again, you know.
Is your team still in the tournament?
Brazil.
Brazil is your team. They're trying to go for that sixth star.
Oh, God, but it's like touch and go. The last game was,
they did.
Pure torture. Hey?
I thought that they received a lot of, well, it wasn't abuse, but, you know, people were basically giving it to them on Twitter after that last game. They said, this Brazil is not looking promising.
Yes.
They don't even look like they deserve to win right now. They don't look like, you know, five World Cup champions or whatever.
Yeah, no, look, this team is battling it, but they don't have the samba moves of Brazil teams of the past, you know?
Yeah.
So, and, you know, where there is flair, you get it from Neymar and things, and then people think, you know, he's this, like this one man show, and you're showing off, and, you know, he tries to dance with the ball and all of that, and it doesn't result in goals.
But also they've got young players on their team, don't they?
But this is the thing. I mean, Brazil is a star team. It was rated number one in the world when they came to 2010. And, you know, what happened here when they got bumped off here is that the whole team and the coach got fired. And they said, right, let's start from scratch. No matter, you know, you can be the star of the show. You can be an international star playing for the best teams of the world. You didn't cut it in 2010. Goodbye.
Mm.
So that's how you had people like Kaká and things, you know, that they're not in the team. And they got this whole new crop of people and started from scratch. And I think that's the problem with Bafana Bafana, is that you don't have
kind
of... Yeah,
boy.
You know, you get like old cows being dragged out to get sent out as the pitch. They'll just keep running until something happens, you know?
Yeah. Look, I don't have a problem with Brazil winning. I would like to see the Netherlands get over that mental block that they seem to have, where they've been in so many World Cup finals, but they haven't just gotten over that last point, the finish line. So for me, it would be nice to see the Netherlands do something.
Yeah, but there is like this current bout of rage against the Netherlands after Arjen Robben's stunt, you know.
A penalty.
Oh, good gosh. Yeah, no, I mean, that's not easily forgivable. But you know, Mabs, you have to have that dream. Fine, you have to give it to Brazil this time. You know, the country is in a bad state. The people are protesting. They need it. They need this win. Like, give them the dream. We couldn't have it. We got like bumped off in the first round.
Yeah.
You know, you need to see somebody like you know, yeah. I live the dream.
No, look, that's a convincing argument. But I think of regardless of whoever wins, it's, you know, it's going to be an interesting remainder of the FIFA World Cup.
Absolutely. It's been, every game has just been stunning. I mean, you had a few boring ones where, like, nothing happens.
Yeah, for the most part, there have been a lot of goals in games.
And a lot of excitement, you know, on both sides of the field. There are very few matches that were tilted one way, you know, where, you can say you don't need to watch it. You can, like, phone your grandmother after 3 weeks and say, hey, sorry, I haven't been in touch, you know, while the game's on. But there are very few like that. Most of them are really, really exciting.
And, of course, the Luis Suarez drama. You know, that whole incident reminded me of the time when Zinedine Zidane headbutted,
yeah.
There's always some incident that you know what? In World Cup year, David Beckham with the that 1 year. Like,
you know, the problem is I'm also a Liverpool supporter, right? So Suarez, I'm having to constantly find excuses for his bad behavior.
Yeah.
And it comes a time where you just can't. You just get, okay, he is a bit of an asshole, like, you know.
What do you make of that 4 month ban? Because some people were saying, you know, it's a bit excessive. It's a bit extreme. It's too much. But on the extreme opposite end, you have people saying, but this is the third time he's been doing it. They can't keep giving him the same punishment. They've got to send a message. They've got to make an example.
With him, I think it's now psychological. His bad behavior is. And so, you know, something has to get through to him. I was listening the other day. There was this discussion about what can he do and what can be done to help him. And somebody was suggesting that, you know, they need to, somebody needs to bite him so that he feels the pain.
So that he knows exactly what he puts out of
his through. Deal with it at that level. So I don't know what's going to help him, you know, because when it happened, it didn't seem as if he realized what he did wrong. It was like, oh, yeah, I tripped and fell.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not good to have people like that. You have people who say, I tripped and fell and my girlfriend got pregnant, you know.
But it is interesting with the Liverpool fans and then also fans of Suarez. It's interesting hear them try to justify, you know, why it's not so bad that he bit the other guy. He's a hugely talented player.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the problem, is that people are trying to weigh that up against all these terrible things being said about him. But at the end of the day, he's a special talent.
Yeah, no, he is. I mean, but look, Gareth is a special talent. Imagine if he went around biting you guys. you don't excuse it just because, you know, he's good at what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. Okay, so let's
Gareth
get into
it. If Gareth does bite
you
guys,
I don't know. My reflex would be to kick him where it hurts him the most.
Okay, that so you won't be like the Italian player who say, never mind.
I won't be like the Italian guy. There won't be no referee telling me how I should behave in an incident like that. I'll just protect myself. Ranjani, let's begin with an article that you wrote for the Daily Maverick regarding the whole e-toll situation. And I call it a situation because I had to remind myself how we got to this point with the whole e-tolls story. So maybe let's go back right to the beginning and then you tell us how exactly we got to this point. Because, you know, it wasn't this smooth sailing, easy process. Mm. It was provincial government trying to implement e-tolls. And then there were discussions with the national government. And then SANRAL came into the picture. It's quite a convoluted story in itself. So take us back to the beginning.
Okay, it is a very complicated story. And with the announcement last week by the Gauteng Premier, David Makura, that, you know, he wants to review it, I have people like from in national government saying to me, what is wrong with this guy? Like, does he not remember how this started off? And how it started off was around 1999, Bazima Shilowa was still the premier of Gauteng at that time. But basically, it was the same leadership, the political leadership. They decided that some of Gauteng's roads were in quite a bad state, in particular the R21 and R24, because they were two-lane freeways.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of congestion, especially going to the airport.
Which impacted on people getting to work.
Yes.
And, you know,
it was
just a mess.
So and it was a major connecting road between Johannesburg and Pretoria as well.
Yeah.
So they were looking at ways to develop those roads, improve the condition, and possibly widen it. So they were looking at funding options, and then somebody, it was the MEC at that time, Ignatius Jacobs, who came up with this model of saying, well, maybe we should toll it. But I don't know at the time whether they had in their heads electronic tolling or just like, you know, the tolls that you have on the N3 when you're going to KZN, you know, where you stop and give the coins. Yes. And also, I think that they were thinking 2 rand, 3 rand, realize what it's going to turn out to be.
So then did it suddenly dawn on them that actually they needed quite a bit of money?
No, what the first we're dealing with the modalities of it, because you see what, in terms of powers, the provincial government can't implement tolling. Only national government has the authority to do so.
Okay.
So Gauteng couldn't do anything about it. So they had to then approach the national government and said, look, we need to do these roads. They're major roads. This R21, R24. The only way we can possibly fund it, because there's no money in the national budget, is maybe to introduce tolling. So the national government said, yeah, okay, we'll think about it. That time, Thabo Mbeki was president and he had like other things on his mind, and he was saving the continent and all of that. So, you know, he said, yeah, okay, come back some other time. So they went 3 times to national government, was turned down. Eventually, on the 3rd time, they said, fine, let's talk about this.
Okay.
And then they said, yeah, look, we need to do these roads, but, you know, tolling seems to be the only way to do it.
So then where's the money going to come from?
Yes. So then national government then pulled in Sanral. At the time, Sanral was just like a small player. Nobody knew who it was. So Sanral was, in the meantime, wanting to improve the condition of the N1 and N3. The N1 and N3 are national roads.
Yes.
So they were wanting to. So they said, oh, wait, let's do this all as this big project. So we'll take the R21, R24, combine it with the N1, N3, N12, and do this massive road construction. Yeah. Tolling, that's a good idea. Let's do it. So national government said, right, go with it. So nobody knew at that time, like, you know, about the, what that would entail. Then comes 2010, the World Cup. And of course, we all went bananas. Yeah, let's have the World Cup.
Yeah.
And we didn't think about the implications of what the road development would have on the broader picture. And government didn't say anything about it, you know, and all the talk about it, when they were talking, for example, of improving the Allendale interchange, because that is a major blockage there on the N1. And they were saying, yeah, you know, we're going to extend that intersection and get a better flow of traffic. They didn't at any time say, you're going to pay for that.
No,
once
didn't.
We do it.
Yeah,
you know?
They were selective with the information.
Yes. So only after Sepp Blatter was flying off with our money in his private jet, then did the thing come up that, oh, by the way, you know those roads that you're enjoying right now, you have to go, you're going to have to pay for. So it was only after 2010 that the discussion came up. So that's the evolution, and that's when the big fight started, you know, about e-tolling and the user pay system, and then COSATU got in the mix. And then Gauteng decided, actually, we don't like this. So national government was saying, hey, you are the guys who came up with this idea. What do you mean you don't like it? Who's going to pay for it?
Well, this is the problem. Who is going to pay for it? Because they're saying that there's a possibility that e-tolls might be scrapped, but I'm saying that that's never going to happen because we still have to account for that money.
Yes, they took a massive loan. There's 20 billion that they owe for those roads. They need to repay it. And it's not just like you can get it from some mashonisa and, you know, just pay it. It's 20 billion, a heck of a lot of money, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing is that the default on that loan is having implications on our economy, because the rating agencies are saying, hold on here, Sanral is a major state-owned enterprise. Why is it not able to meet its loan requirements? So it means that the South African government and all its agencies are in trouble. So that is why it is lowering the credit rating on it. So what happens with Sanral is not just, you know, we hate Sanral, so, you know, let it, like, you know, fall over and die. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's not that, because it has implication for the broader economy. So that's why President Zuma was under pressure to sign that e-toll bill, because he signed it in September last year, and everybody's saying, what's wrong with you? There's an election coming. Why would you introduce e-tolls?
It's just going to make us look bad.
Yes, and that's why Gauteng, the ANC got hammered in Gauteng, you know, and why it came close to 53%, because the timing was all wrong.
So then the fact that the Premier is now coming out, because he's saying things like he wants to have a panel assembled, they can review the structure. What exactly does he want to happen now?
Exactly, because we all know what's going to happen in that panel. There's going to be a queue of people. They say, we hate e-tolls, taking away all our money. It's this horrible purple lights that keep, you know, reminding us every time we drive under it how much of money is going out of our pockets.
I've heard a lot of people say they pull a zap sign every time they drive.
Yes, oh no, lots of people. Yeah,
underneath
I know.
The gantry.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we hate these e-tolls.
Yes. No, well, I have a little niece who's 4 and who loves the gantry. She says, please, can we go again? So, yeah, I'd go bankrupt if I have to listen to her.
This is but true. She just likes the pretty blue lights,
the
I'm
pretty
sure.
lights, yeah. But the thing is that it's not so easy just to undo it. Firstly, David Makura announces this panel, but he doesn't have the powers to undo ETOLS because it's a national competence.
So then why is he even giving us
this is the thing.
Hope.
This is
hope.
The bizarre thing because everybody was, yes, David Makura for president. Mm. But, you know, this can just be a big PR exercise. Mm. What he can be doing is using it to lobby again with national government and say, look, this is what the panel found. It's not working out. It's having a bad impact on business. And, you know, it's impoverishing ordinary citizens. We have to do something about it. If he does that, though, national government can say, listen, it was you guys who came up with this idea.
Yeah.
So why are you now, and who's going to pay for it?
Yes, the money has to come from somewhere.
It has to come from somewhere.
Someone.
So, I mean, there's been the suggestion of this fuel levy and things like that. But even that is problematic.
Now, how are they suggesting that that is going to work?
Well, you see, initially the idea was there'd be a national fuel levy and then you can pay it off quickly. Mm-hmm. But then people are arguing, so why will some poor guy in Tsitsikamma have to pay for Gauteng roads when he's never been to Gauteng and his petrol costs. The counter argument to that is Gauteng is the economic hub. Everything comes from Gauteng. So, you know, everybody has to support the economy of Gauteng.
What are the potential dangers that the premier is now doing, giving us this false hope? Because, and I stand to be corrected, even though this process is under review, we're still expected to keep paying
exactly.
for ETOL. So he's not saying stop paying and then we'll go and review the process and get back to you. No, we still have to keep paying.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem for SANRAL and national government at the moment is there's the high level of non-compliance. So a lot of people, including me, and not paying for using the roads.
Yeah.
And at some stage, they're gonna have to review. Well, they've been trying to get the numbers straight, and SANRAL have been lying about the number of people who are e-tagged and registered and things like that. But the higher the numbers of defiance, the bigger the problem of keeping it going. So what David Makura's announcement does is makes even more people say, even people who are registered say, well, I'm just going to keep getting the bills and wait until this panel is complete with its work.
I'm not even getting any bills. And there are not a lot of people like me walking around, but I'm yet to receive a single bill for e-tolls.
The thing is that the billing system is a major problem.
It's
because
a mess.
Some people don't get bills. Other people in Durban, who are like an old granny in Durban who has never driven a car, getting bills.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing, because you have this disparity now, and there's no way, you know, to kind of be supportive of a system that's not credible. Mm. Because if the system is not operating, why would you volunteer to pay into it and it's going to a big black hole? And, you know, there's two dangers. One is that the money's not accounted for, and two is that it could be stopped and you're definitely not going to get your money back.
Essentially, what this whole process has revealed is that there was bad planning and getting, you know, the infrastructure set up on our roads, and now government are trying to fix the situation. And unfortunately, we're still going to be paying for these roads.
Oh, absolutely.
I really don't think that we're going to escape that in any way.
No, no. I mean, even if there is a vague possibility of the e-tolls being scrapped and the gantries being used to hang Christmas decorations or whatever they're going to do with them.
They can become national monuments or something. Okay.
Yeah, but we're still going to have to pay through the fuel levy.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to bring in Rebecca Davis now. She's also with the Daily Maverick. Remember, if you do want to be a part of our discussion this afternoon, you can call us on 0861-555-189. You can also send us your messages on the Cliff Central official account through WeChat. But Rebecca Davis, also from the Daily Maverick, she's written an article on the website regarding the Oscar Pistorius case that's, of course, resumed. That was a big talking point when Oscar and his team and the state went back into court yesterday. And Rebecca, Oscar has done a good job of staying out of the papers up until this point. I mean, considering the spotlight that he's under, he's basically under a magnifying glass. You know, but he's laying low. He's keeping quiet into himself.
He has, and it actually probably speaks volumes as to the kind of security and privacy measures at Weskopie's hospital in Gauteng, that no media managed to get a single photo of him on the premises, no leaked reports from nurses, absolutely nothing of the kind while he was undergoing his 30-day psychiatric observation. Because we know, for instance, that the same hasn't been true of Shireen Dawani's day at Falkenberg in Cape Town, where we've had a number of little tabloid reports about how Shireen is doing, how Shireen is responding to noises, and pictures of Shireen walking around the grounds. So really props to Weskopie's for keeping everything under wraps there and safeguarding his privacy while he was under observation.
All right, so Rebecca, Oscar spent 30 days at Weskopie's, you know, as a day patient. And then yesterday, all these reports get handed in into court. What exactly happened? Were the details of these reports shared with the court? Did they go onto the court record? What do we know of what's happened over the last 30 days?
Yeah, I think it would have been pleased to the more voyeuristic among us if we got to hear the full details of what is in those reports. But it doesn't seem as if that's going to happen, and maybe that is wise in order to obviously protect Pistorius's privacy. Basically, all that happened was that the reports got handed to Judge Masipa. We were just told the crucial element, which is that the team of three psychologists and one psychiatrist did not find that Pistorius was suffering from a generalized anxiety disorder, which caused him to not be able to differentiate between right and wrong on the evening when he killed Reeva Steenkamp. So that was the level of detail we were given. That was it. It was indicated that both defense and prosecution do accept that finding, though they indicated that they may come back to it at a later stage, but there isn't any huge contestation about that. Now, today, BBC journalist Andrew Harding tweeted that he had been reliably informed by a source that the psychologist's report also goes further and says, not only did Pistorius not have the disorder that caused him not to be able to be differentiated between right and wrong, but he also did not suffer from a generalized anxiety disorder, period. Now, if that is accurate, it means that Judge Masipa will essentially have to discard the testimony of the defense witness, Dr. Merrill Forster, who was the psychiatrist who testified that Pistorius did have this disorder. And it also doesn't leave the defense in a particularly strong position then, because Forster's evidence that he was so anxious, that he was so kind of clinically anxious, that he would have responded in this hyper-thought manner to a perceived threat, now is discredited by independent psychologists.
And Rebecca, this also has implications for his appeal, right? If he isn't convicted.
You mean the report?
Well, the findings is because there's little room to maneuver in the event of the defense wanting to appeal a conviction if that does occur.
Right. So because Pistorius has gone for observation now, the state has cut off the possibility that the defense could have demanded observation later as grounds for an appeal. But as Ranjini says, they could use the report as part of an appeal. Also, in terms of mitigation of sentence, when it comes to the sentencing aspect, the report may become of more value if Judge Masipa chooses to take certain aspects of it, because we obviously don't know what the full thing is, but there may still, even if he doesn't have generalized anxiety disorder, there still may be aspects of it which he could use in mitigation of sentencing. And as you say, possibly as grounds for a further appeal as well.
Now, Rebecca, you say that this doesn't look good for the defense, but is this an obvious good thing for the prosecution, though? Because, you know, their biggest goal is still convincing the judge that there was motive. I mean, does the fact that it was concluded by these four experts that Oscar Pistorius, in fact, does not suffer from any kind of mental disorder, is that an obvious win for the state?
Okay, well, let's remember here, the confusing thing about South African law is that you criminal law is that you don't have to prove motive, which often seems inexplicable to most of us. I know it does to me. You only have to prove intent.
Okay.
They don't necessarily have to build this big story about why exactly he did it, etc. They just have to show that he intended to kill Steenkamp. So from that perspective, I do think it is a win for the state, because Pistorius's version that he was shooting at an imagined intruder really depends on him being this incredibly sort of hyper-vigilant, paranoid, uber-anxious individual. And if psychologists are saying, well, he may be anxious, but he's not pathologically anxious, then it does seem to lessen the validity of that account.
Oh, have we lost Rebecca? No,
no, I'm here.
Okay, Rebecca, you're still there. Oh, no, we just heard a horrible noise in our headphones. I thought we'd lost you there for a second. Okay, and then besides that, then we also saw Dr. Fansfeld, who was also in the stand yesterday. Now, this is the doctor who operated on Oscar Pistorius as a child, correct? He was the one that amputated his limbs.
That's right. So obviously it must be quite something to have tended to Oscar as a doctor literally from his birth, to have been the medical professional who advised Oscar's parents to amputate his legs, and then later to be called to testify in his murder trial. I mean,
now,
it's really quite something.
Now, what is the defense trying to establish, though, through the doctor's testimony? How is this going to help their case?
They were trying to establish that Oscar is physically vulnerable, particularly without his legs, so that he may respond to threat in a more anxious fashion than an able-bodied person would, just because he is not as physically able to move away from that threat or whatever. And they were secondly trying to prove that Oscar on his stumps without his legs is so unstable that he could not have gone on his stumps to the door and swung a cricket bat with both hands at the door, at bathroom door, as the state claims, because he simply would have fallen over. And that is exactly what Fansfeld testified.
And then did anyone else take the stand after Fansfeld yesterday? I know there was at least one interruption with the equipment that the stenographer uses malfunctioning or something to that nature. Did anybody else take the stand?
Yes. So after that, we had sound expert Dr. Ivan Lin, who also carried on testifying today. Now, the interesting thing is this is the only acoustics expert, dedicated acoustics expert, that the defense team has called. And there are two significant aspects to their case which rest around sound. The first is the claim that when Oscar Pistorius screams, it sounds like a woman is screaming. And this is obviously hugely important for the defense's case because neighbors, witnesses, have claimed that they heard a woman screaming. And if Reva Steenkamp was screaming, then obviously Pistorius would have been alerted to her presence in the bathroom and shouldn't have been shooting. So the defense claims what they actually heard was Pistorius screaming.
Okay.
So we thought that what Ivan Lin would testify was that he'd done tests on Pistorius screaming, and he could confirm that Pistorius screaming does indeed sound like a woman screaming. But it soon became clear that actually this isn't the MO that the defense has decided to pursue, that instead they are going for a much more ambiguous point, which is that it's very hard for people at a long distance to tell with accuracy much about a scream.
So are you saying that they're now changing their story?
They're not changing it. They're merely saying it could have been a woman screaming or it could have been a man screaming. They seem to have abandoned the very specific claim that Pistorius' voice uniquely sounds like a woman. They're just saying could have been a man, could have been a woman. It's very difficult to tell over distances of over 100 meters in some cases with the neighbor witnesses. But to be honest, I didn't find Lynn's testimony particularly earth-shattering because at the end of his time on the stand today, all we'd really got to was that he couldn't say for certain that the neighbors hadn't heard a woman screaming. He just said it might have been a man screaming. So it wasn't as if that testimony necessarily took us further. Now, the second sound-related aspect, which is of huge significance to this case, is the claim on the defense's part that the gunshots fired could sound like a cricket bat smashing a door from a distance. And it surely is of interest that Ivan Lin, the dedicated sound expert, did not offer a word of testimony about this, despite being the obviously most qualified person to do so. So what we're left with in that regard is the testimony of two previous defense witnesses, the rather discredited Roger Dixon and forensics expert Wally Volmont, neither of whom are dedicated sound experts, who carried out various tests and said, yes, well, could be a gunshot, could be a cricket bat. But I think it's interesting that Lin himself didn't testify on that.
Rebecca, going back to Pistorius' voice and screams, I'm pretty sure that earlier in the trial there was a suggestion that there were sound tests conducted on him. There was testing of his voice. Did that come up?
Yeah, you're right, Ranjini, and that's what we were expecting. There was definitely some mention earlier in the trial that they carried out tests on Pistorius. I think Barry Rue was foreshadowing it, saying, well, when we bring out those tests, you will see that Pistorius does indeed sound like a woman. Where these tests are now, we don't know. They certainly haven't been mentioned in the last 2 days. There's been no indication that they are, in fact, going to be produced. And obviously, I think a lot of us have been wondering whether, in fact, they might get Pistorius just to scream somewhere there in the courtroom, and that clearly is not going to happen either. So, where are those tests?
Yeah, but it's also just not a normal scream, so you can't just say, hey, scream.
Well, this
it
is
has
the
to
thing.
Be a terrified scream.
He would have to be, you know, under the similar circumstances that he claims he was under that night. He'd have to be, you know, petrified. He'd have to be anxious. He'd have to be under those exact same conditions.
Well, there are some scary journalists in that court. Maybe they can all jump on him simultaneously.
You're right, though. Not only would they have to somehow replicate the conditions of Pistorius being under duress in that manner, which is obviously impossible, but the sound expert made it clear that the most minuscule aspects of the environment can change how sound is perceived. For instance, he said even the length of the grass could change how sound is perceived. So, I mean, to try and replicate a sound test under those strictures seems almost impossible.
But I think it's quite interesting that they're not introducing the evidence on the testing of his voice now, even though that was done. And I remember there was something about tests being conducted at his house, sound tests being conducted at his house at the same time the shooting occurred. So it's interesting that they're not bringing that up. It could be a suggestion that the results do not favor their case.
And that's what I think, to be honest. The only reason I can think also about why Ms. Benn has not testified about the cricket bat and gunshot thing is because the results didn't work out. I mean, I literally cannot think why else he wouldn't have given testimony on that. And when there are these gaps that, I mean, you and I as lay people can see, then you have to assume that that's the reason why it isn't being brought up. I had an interesting suggestion today from a law academic in England who suggested to me that the defense case at this stage has all the hallmarks of being demanded by the accused rather than being led by the defense team themselves. And that's obviously a very interesting suggestion, that maybe Pistorius himself is having a hand in this that we don't realize, and perhaps not often, I mean, not always in ways that would perhaps necessarily benefit his case entirely.
Well, this is kind of an odd defense, and it is an extraordinary case. So you would expect that, you know, things that don't feature in a normal criminal trial will be here. But I suppose there are other circumstances as well, such as, you know, the fact that he is a paraplegic and, he had previous cases, where he acted strangely under duress, and, you know, his relationship with guns and things like that. So this hasn't been quite an ordinary criminal trial.
It hasn't, but I've got to say that these last witnesses, because we've got every reason to believe that the guy who's currently on the stand, who's Pete from Sale, who's Pistorius' agent manager, is either the last witness or definitely one of the very last, but second last. And if this is the way they're concluding the case, I've got to say I'm not blown away that this is the best defense money can buy you. I mean, Pete Kinsale, who's on the stand at the moment, he's been Pistorius' manager since 2006. He's in charge of all Pistorius' sponsorship. So obviously the chances that we're going to get anything approaching a neutral testimony from this guy are very, very scant.
It's too close to home, yeah.
Exactly. And he also sounds like a character witness.
That's exactly the thing. He has now introduced this raft of character evidence. And so the if I've got time to briefly explain, the rules around character evidence in South African law are quite complex. But basically, the rule is that you can't admit evidence as to the accused's character because it's basically irrelevant, because we all know that good people do bad things and bad people do good things. And so what? Because you did one thing nasty once doesn't mean you'll do it again. But you can introduce character evidence if the other side does it first. So whereas the state couldn't just come in and say, oh, Pistorius did this, this, and this, and he was an asshole on this occasion, because the defense has produced this agent who's basically making out that Pistorius is a saint, he says he's never seen Pistorius acting disrespectfully to any woman, that Pistorius only lost his temper twice, etc. Because they've opened that door, the state can now come back with a whole bunch of evidence to the contrary, which makes it seem like a really, really risky move on Barry Roux's part.
But I think the state's case, there was some suggestion of it. For example, the testimony of Samantha Taylor, Pistorius' ex-girlfriend, and also the incident at Tasha's. Wasn't that leaning towards character evidence?
The incident at Tasha's is admissible because he actually faces charges about that, remember?
Mm-hmm.
That it was the setting off a gun in public or whatever. Samantha Taylor was, yeah, I would say that in retrospect does seem to be leading towards character evidence, particularly because she was testifying as to the fact that he, I don't know, shouted at her and was on his phone the whole time and so forth. So you're right. They have. It's not like this is unprecedented in this trial, but coming at this very late stage of the game, it does seem to be a risky move.
Rebecca, the fact that Samantha Taylor also tweeted during the process of the trial, is that in any way going to put any sort of, you know, risk on her testimony? Like, does that compromise that situation in any way?
No, I don't think so. As far as I recall, she tweeted after she had testified.
After
I think
she maybe gotten off the stand.
Mm. Yeah, I think that might be a critical difference there. But even so, she wasn't tweeting anything in contradiction of her testimony or anything. I think she was just saying that Pistorius is a liar, which is basically what we all got from her testimony anyway, from reading between the lines. So I don't think that would have prejudiced the case in any way.
But the defense case, from what you're saying, it looks like quite an anticlimax from where this case started. For example, you know, Barry Roux, in his cross-examination of the state witnesses, everybody was completely enthralled with him. You know, he looked like a kind of bulldog lawyer, and it looked as if he was gonna, you know, come out fighting in the defense case. And considering the amount of resources and preparation that went into the defense case, it does look as if it's tapering off now.
Mm. I find it very strange. I mean, if we look back on the defense case, and it's a bit difficult because we've had this 5.5 week break, so we've practically forgotten everything that happened. But I think possibly their strongest witnesses have been those neighbors who lived right next door to Pistorius, so not at the distance of the state's witnesses, who testified that they didn't hear any screaming. And I mean, that isn't necessarily a case winner because they didn't hear anything, right? I mean, they didn't hear screams, so they didn't hear anything, so they must just sleep extraordinarily heavily. But at least that allowed them to sort of neutralize some of the state witness testimony. The other thing I think the defense has done successfully is to beat down the state's suggestion that Pistorius was wearing legs when he bashed down the bathroom door with a cricket bat. And I'm not sure why the state felt it necessary to pursue the suggestion so strongly, because it's not as if it has any material bearing on his guilt or innocence. Yet they really pegged a lot to this idea that he was wearing his stumps, possibly because it adds to the sort of premeditated notion that he had time, etc. But, I mean, there does seem to be a fair amount of forensic evidence to suggest that he wasn't wearing his stumps when he, I mean, sorry, that he was wearing his stumps when he, when, I'm getting confused now. that he was wearing his stumps, his legs rather, when he bashed in the door.
Rebecca, from a viewing perspective, because, you know, most of us, this was sort of the first opportunity for the average South African to be given an insight into court proceedings and how things actually unfold. You as journalists, you know, you are in the thick of it almost every single day. But what happens next? Because, you know, once Barry Roux is done calling his witnesses, then what's going to be the next step? Closing arguments, and then that's going to entail a break. And then the judge is going to need another break to go and, you know, consolidate her judgment. How long is this going to play out still?
Ages, in short. Basically, they'll conclude the case hopefully this week, in the next few days. Then they take a break for closing arguments. So, to prepare the closing arguments, rather. So when we had this 5.5 week gap, Judge Masipa indicated that she did expect the lawyers to start working on their closing arguments then. So she may give them slightly less time than she would ordinarily have because she does think they've already had this break. And actually, it seems that they did use some of the break for doing breaky stuff since Sean Pollock tweeted a picture of himself playing cricket with Kerry Nell last week. So clearly they weren't just beavering away all the time. Anyway, so when they get, so that could be anything from a few weeks to closing arguments. Then they'll deliver the closing arguments, which will take, I don't know, a few days a week. Then we'll adjourn again, as you say, for Judge Masipa to write her judgment. I have heard from a source that she has started writing her judgment already. But to me, that is just an indication of how long it's going to be, which means that when she eventually comes to read it, it's also going to take days and days probably. But we've also heard that Judge Masipa has some business intervening between that period of closing arguments and her delivering her judgment, which may delay it further. So I'd say we could be looking at, you know, months, certainly weeks rather than days.
Well, I think if she is writing her judgment, because what they normally have to do in a judgment is review all the evidence. So I think she's probably noting down everything that's already happened. It may not be that, you know, she's already preparing, you know, the main part of the judgment. But the other thing to consider is the lawyers as well as the judge also have other cases. So it's not as if, you know, they're just doing this. So I suppose, you know, that the time factor would also depend on the other cases they're sitting on and how much time they can set aside for the Oscar trial. But the other thing, Rebecca, is that at the end of the day, it'll all come down to Oscar's evidence, isn't it? Isn't he the main witness for the defense?
I suppose that's right. I mean, as we've said on numerous occasions, he's the only person, the only eyewitness to events. He's the only person who knows what really happened. And pretty much everyone, well, legal experts, commentators, etc., seem to be fairly convinced that he didn't do a good job on the stand, that his version was inconsistent and improbable, basically. And if that's what Masipa is going on, because you're right, it doesn't seem that a lot of the other, even very technical evidence, has been black and white.
Yes.
I mean, everything from blood spatter to ballistics to sound has been open to interpretation. And we've heard, I mean, if I had a rant for every time an expert has said this is not an exact science, I would have at least 4 to 5 rand, because it's an acknowledgement that there is so much up in the air about this case.
Yeah.
So if, as you say, it comes down to what Oscar says happened that night, then frankly, I think he might be in trouble because
it's such a high profile case and it's, you know, it's under the spotlight and it's playing out under this magnifying glass. It just puts even more pressure when, you know, considering the details that are involved.
That's true, although I don't think it's likely that Judge Masipa will use the fact that it's under the microscope to, for instance, deliver a harsher sentence than she might otherwise have wanted to. Because, for instance, she had the opportunity to really send a message and make an example of the stories by making him an inpatient at this copies, and she chose instead to make him a day patient, saying that she didn't want to punish him twice and so forth. But that suggests to me that she's not necessarily swayed by considerations of, you know, everyone looking at her and thinking, what are you going to do, and so forth.
Rebecca Davis from the Daily Maverick, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Very insightful, just giving us an update on the whole Oscar Pistorius trial that continues throughout the week. Ranjani, just to wrap things up here with you and I in the studio, I also want to touch on the NUMSA strike that essentially went into effect today. We've just managed to contain the situation with the strike in the platinum industry, and now here's this other strike. I'm pretty sure people are nervous at this point. Would that be correct?
There's a lot of nervousness around the strike because the indication from NUMSA and its members is that they're willing to go the whole hog. They're willing to go as far as it needs to be taken in order to get their demands met, and also because the platinum strike was a bit distant from us. You know, it was there in Rustenburg. It was very much contained in that community. This NUMSA strike will affect a whole lot of people.
Mm.
So if you need to go and have your tires fixed, you know.
You better learn how to start
fixing your tires yourself. It's across the board. It affects, you know, manufacturing. It affects a whole range of sectors in the economy. So, you know, it will have a direct impact on ordinary South Africans. So it's not the kind of thing where, you know, you listen on the news bulletins or, you know, and just check what is going on in the platinum strike and say, oh, it's still going on, the poor people. This time it's going to, you know, you're going to feel the pinch for it. So, and also, you know, NUMSA is an extremely militant union.
Mm.
Irvin Jim is that if he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it.
Mm.
And, you know, you could see with Joseph Matundra, the president of AMCU, you know, I don't think he's as kind of hard-assed as Van Gym is. So I think that's why people are a lot more nervous with this one. And you found that a government was trying to intervene to say, please, let's do something at the last minute. Let's try and stop this from happening. It couldn't because, you know, I think apart from the demands, which is now at around 12% for the wage increase.
Yes.
There are other things that NUMSA is also demanding, such as the elimination of labor brokers, and he's asking that employers disregard the youth wage subsidy. Now, the employers are saying, excuse me, what has this got to do with us?
Yeah.
You know, we are just abiding by the law here, and you bring in all these demands, which you actually should be negotiating with government, not us.
They have nothing to do with us.
Exactly. So, you know, but I think NUMSA is also trying to prove some political point in the demand. So that's what makes the strike a lot more complicated than the platinum strike.
Because the strike affects so many more people, as you explained, do you think there is going to be pressure to have these demands met as quickly as possible? Because the last thing you want is a 5-month long strike in this sector.
No, absolutely. I think you're going to get some, you know, a lot more intervention and behind the scenes negotiating, because the last thing you want is an angry Irvin Jim with a hell of a lot of airtime screaming at everybody, you know, consistently, because besides the impact on South Africa, you know, it can frighten the investor community to say, but what is going on with this country? You know, you just come out of one damaging strike and then step right into another one. And, you know, 200,000 workers on strike is not something to be laughed at.
Mm-mm.
But also, you know, the other thing is that, you know, when violence happens with the mining strike, it happens there amongst other people, you know, like from other unions. Here, when there's violence in this kind of strike, it's violence against employers. So, for example, if people want to go to work and NUMSA members know that so-and-so has gone to work, apparently I heard that there was an incident this morning where they went to that place, they broke the gate, they broke windows. You see, so they sabotage the company.
Yeah.
So it's going to cause, you know, a lot of fear amongst people who do want to work, and also the employers, you know, the ordinary companies such as, you know, like a garage or, you know, a service station, they won't know what to do or how to react.
Do you think NUMSA are sitting there pretty confident? Because, you know, they must have said, look at the impact that the platinum strike had and look how long it lasted. We've got these guys by their balls. Do you think that they're sitting there pretty confident?
I think so. They know that this is exactly the right time to pounce. You know, they've got a double agenda here. One is to serve the interests of their workers and get a higher wage. And secondly, you know, they are wanting to start a political organization. And in order to do that, you can't launch something in opposition to the ANC when everything is fine and hunky-dory and everybody is getting on well. They're going to have to increase the temperature and, you know, get things to breaking point. And I think that they're going to use the strike to do precisely that.
And then finally, on the Akgang SA debacle that unfolded over the weekend, where some Akgang members wanted to have Dr. Mampela Rampele suspended. What was the reason for all of that?
Oh, gosh. You know, the only thing worse than this woman drinking up all our airtime, you know, for all these months, for the past year. Imagine if she had been, like, had these huge numbers of people and the circus was going on. Can you imagine? They're just a small group of people. They basically can't agree on which coffee to drink in their office. You know, and making a whole. So now they've instituted a disciplinary hearing, but it's a faction of Akgang. I don't know what's a faction in Akgang, like two people.
Exactly.
Because they've got only two members in parliament.
This is true.
You know, and they're fighting about that. They're fighting about finances. Yeah, they're saying that she's bullying people. She is overexerting her authority and that she's not consulting. You know, it cannot get worse. You know, we all thought that COPE was as bad as it gets.
Well, this is the thing. I'm getting flashbacks from the COPE days when they started squabbling amongst themselves and look where they ended.
Well, exactly. But at least with COPE, they were, you know, you could see a group of people.
So basically it's going to be an even worse ending than it was for Cope.
It looks like it. And Cope, it took a while to get here. It took basically 5 years for Cope to disintegrate. But with this, I mean, they're starting off, they're disintegrating as it goes.
But isn't this also showing that there's obviously deep-rooted issues bubbling underneath the surface here?
Well, this is the thing. I think from the start, that the problem with it was that Akgang was built around a single personality. And, we didn't really know beyond that what they had to offer. And that's part of the reason why they didn't get votes is because, especially when Dr. Rampile was then going to the DA and coming back and, if you are going to vest your entire political organization on one party, you've got to be pretty sure that you know what this person is about. But I think, and then all of a sudden after the election, she's taking a break. She got all zen on us and she's going to meditate and then suddenly she's fighting. Yeah. So nobody knows what exactly she's doing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, that maybe it's a good thing that, we're not exposed to her any longer.
It might not be the worst thing in the world. Yes. Stopped.
You gotta know things are pretty bad when you think that Julius Malema is actually the sane one. He's together, he's organized, and Dr. Rampile is not.
And he got the million votes in the general election. So there you go. Ranjini Munsami, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon for News Talk with the Daily Maverick. This is CliffCentral.com.